I'm actually not going to read that again. So if you would like to follow along, if you haven't got an app thing, would anyone like a Bible from the back room? If you'd like to go and get one, or someone would like to find you one, stick your hand up if you don't know where they are. Does anyone want a Bible? Because it's quite a long passage, and you might want to have it on your lap. Not that I want to convert us into one of those churches where people bring their Bibles. So we're looking at John chapter 4. It's most of the chapter. It's verse 1 to 42. Right. And I'm talking about this today at the request of Tim, who said if I talked about this, he'd come. So here he is. It's straight up bribery. So first I want to talk a little bit about... I'm going to give you a whole lot of packaging, and then we'll look at the story with those things in mind. The first thing I want you to think about is how you read the Bible. And there are lots of ways to read the Bible, and I'm wanting to talk about two in particular. One of which is to think about what my questions and my issues and my concerns are, and pick up the Bible as a resource to help me sort that out. 2 weeks ago, we put a whole lot of things on the board that were things we struggle with or things we find challenging in Christianity or in the Bible. And this would be within that approach, to take one of those things off the board and bring it to the Bible to see what might it say about that. What might the Bible say about violence? What might the Bible say about the place of women? What might the Bible say about appropriate attitudes to other religions? Another way to pick up your Bible is to pick it up and try and say, what was this text trying to do in the first place? Who was it talking to originally, and what was it trying to say to them? And then from that perspective, say, out of this thing that it was trying to do originally, is there anything for me? And it might not be about my current issues or concerns. That's my preference of how I approach the Bible, and that's my preference of how I stand up and speak. It's never pure, because obviously I also bring my issues and concerns. Both are legitimate ways to read the Bible. This passage opens itself up to bringing your issues and concerns, because there is so much in it with flags raising for possible things. Is this going to tell us something about baptism? Is this going to tell us something about doctrines of the Trinity, or about women in leadership, or pluralism, or how is the right way to worship? Or how to be a successful evangelist. And these are all things which various commentaries that I've picked up look at as what's in this passage. And they're good things, and they are. There are clues to all those issues. But what if I peel back and say, was the author of the Gospel of John actually talking about any of those things? Then I'm in the context of a book which is written to convince an early audience of the significance of Jesus and the need to respond to him. That's the overarching framing of what John's on about. So within that context, I'm going to try and have a look at what might be going on in this passage. But I also invite you, particularly if you're only up for listening to little bits today, to hold on to what are the issues and concerns that you are bringing, because out of what it says, maybe there will be something that is a clue for you in what you've brought. If you're not wanting to follow all the way through, maybe sit with what questions would you like to ask this woman at the well, or this Jesus at the well? There's two main ways that this passage has been traditionally read. One is that it's an illustration of the conversion process. It illustrates in one encounter that encountering Jesus is a transformative experience, that the woman moves from scepticism through to faith and then on to being a messenger, to passing that on. So it's a sort of a psychological dialogue in that sense of how we then can imitate her transformation. The other traditional reading that you're probably familiar with is that Jesus meets a terrible, sinful, outcast woman and demonstrates God's love by crossing boundaries, demonstrates that God crosses boundaries and includes people. And the outcast, in gratitude and joy, goes and brings her whole community and everyone lives happily ever after. And neither of those are bad. They're both legitimate good readings, because Jesus does preach a kingdom of inclusion and a kingdom of transformation from scepticism to faith. But there's some bumpy patches if you're reading it that way. The context in that wasn't included because it's narrative, so it's harder to do with puppets, is that at the start, the temple authorities are worried about Jesus because more people are following him than John the Baptist. He's baptizing, there's a bigger following. And then they have this discussion at the well about water, and then in the middle of nowhere, Jesus says, "Come, bring your husband." And on either of those traditional readings, that's an extremely abrupt piece that doesn't really flow, and it breaks a conversation about water and a conversation about worship practices into two halves that don't seem to influence each other. So within those readings, that's the rub that you need to sit with, is how do I hold this strange and abrupt turn? And also, Jesus is actually not very nice to her. He's quite rude, actually, in the way he just says, "Give me some water, and bring your husband." And, well, actually, when she raises questions about religious practice, you can read the way he speaks to her as quite dominant. He's saying, "Well, actually, my tradition has got more in it than yours." So if it's about being converted to something, or if it's about the welcoming of the outcast, some of these things are awkward in the narrative and need to be held. So I'm going to have a look at another angle today. The first thing I want to say is that the text doesn't actually say that she's adulterous or sexually immoral. It is possible to read it that way. But my flags go up because it's the possible reading that best serves the patriarchy to have a sexually immoral woman in this role, because it's the reading of the description that most easily allows her to be dismissed and not taken seriously, particularly not to be taken seriously as a person. So I'd like you to consider another alternative reading of the facts we're given. Because all it actually says is, "Go and call your husband. I do not have a husband." "You are right, you do not have a husband. You had five husbands, and the man you are with now is not your husband." That's the sum total of what we know, with the possible flag that she's there in the middle of the day, which on her own, which is potentially culturally unlikely for women in that culture. So within those small amounts of clues, perhaps we have a woman whose husband died young, and so, as was culturally expected, she married her brother, the husband's brother. And then he also died, as did the next brother, as did the cousin who then took on the responsibility. There may have been a family condition. Maybe they had something genetic. So then a neighbour took her in and married her, and he also died. And now the community is really afraid of her. Is she a black widow? Is she actually knocking them off? Will her bad luck rub off? Is she cursed? And she's probably wondering this herself. But in a culture where a woman requires a male patron economically to survive, she's starving. And so a man in the village takes her into his home, but he doesn't actually want to marry her. Maybe the curse will get him. Maybe he already has a young wife. And maybe the young wife goes at the expected time in the morning with the other young wives to the well. And the sad widow, who can't face the fear in their eyes, goes at lunchtime. Now, I will grant that that is an exercise in the imagination, but it is equally an exercise in imagination to translate the passage, as some people have done, as "the man you're with now is not your husband," and to assume that she walked out on five men, and probably actually was with them in overlapping relationships, so they all got cheated on, and now she's sleeping freely with anyone in town who'll have her. Both are working your imagination on a very slim amount of information. Let's today hold the possibility that she's a woman who's had a run of terrible misfortune. I also think we need to look at whether we construct her as a woman rather than allowing her to be an individual. Anne Thurston talks about the way we are enculturated to read the Gospels with brackets whenever there's a woman character, so that then it becomes a special issue about women rather than a person encountering Jesus with things to say about Jesus' relationship with people. If you allow her to be defined by her gender, then she's really easy to dismiss. Sexually immoral Samaritan woman is a stereotype, and a two-dimensional stereotype, a figure two-dimensional that the story can use to pour Jesus' message into and pour it out again. But the Gospel of John in particular doesn't actually have two-dimensional characters, particularly female characters. Some of the male characters in John are quite stereotyped and flat, but the female characters are always independent, intriguing, individual, intelligent. They're really interesting. You have Mary and Martha in full colour. Jesus' mother Mary is given colour in John. Mary Magdalene is such an intriguing character. Very strong characters. In fact, deliberately set up often to parallel male characters who are not as strong. So this woman at the well is a deliberate parallel with Nicodemus in the previous chapter. And Nicodemus is a shady character who we're not quite sure if he even got to faith, and he's depicted as a stereotypical Pharisee. He's really deliberately stereotyped. But Jesus doesn't encounter Samaritan woman. He relates to this particular person who happens to be both woman and Samaritan. And the characteristics of woman and Samaritan are noted specifically in the narrative, and they're emphasised a couple of times. I think because John is raising the stereotype so that he can dismiss it. He's raising it, he's using it as a symbol, which I'll talk about a little more. He's challenging it, and then he's walking past it. When the disciples return, the text says, they saw Jesus talking with a woman and they wondered about that, but nobody said anything. So it's got this suspicious mind, the sense of this stereotype has been seen. And I think the clue in them not saying anything is a clue to the reader. We expect you also to not say anything about that. But they are symbolic layers. John works in symbolic layers. Two people have a robust conversation, engaging Jewish-Samaritan relationships, engaging a schism of over 800 years. And the author thinks this is so significant that he devotes nearly a whole chapter to it. And then the commentators want to determine how many men she slept with. I think it is important to rescue women characters from patriarchal interpretations, but it's to rescue people for a fair hearing, not to make them heroes. Just because she's a woman in a patriarchal text, in a patriarchal society, doesn't mean she needs to be the best character or the hero in this passage. We can sometimes have a white, Western educated sense of, don't worry, we'll save you, and leap into our texts, which is good for peeling off interpretive layers that are from cultures between us and them that we don't need anymore. But this woman does not need saving. When you meet this woman at the well, she will look after herself. If you're not listening to all of what I'm saying, I'd invite you to have an imaginative encounter with this woman at the well. Just go to that well and see what she's got to say with you, because I reckon she's probably a better theologian than I am. I need to acknowledge also that this story holds a great deal of significance for communities of colour, of which obviously I am not. So I'm speaking very tentatively about someone else's important text, because Jesus is of the dominant class and he enters the ghetto by going to Samaria. and he engages with the people that the dominant class hated and feared. So in that, there's a text of affirming the value and the legitimacy of those who are oppressed and excluded. And there's lots of parallels for that, particularly in American black churches hold this text very highly. It speaks to them of how they are expected to navigate a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus in dominant white culture, white Christian culture. As a wealthy white preacher, I don't feel qualified to talk to you about what it means for people of colour. But I wanted to bring that voice into this space and allow it to just sit here so that we're aware of that as we engage with the text. And I need to acknowledge that the reason I don't feel this is, I don't feel that the story's actually talking about racism. I think that's one of those issues that we've brought to the text to find out what it could help us with. But I have to acknowledge that it could be my white privilege that is keeping me from seeing that. What I do think this passage is about is placing Jesus' overall message within the context of the religious traditions of his day. Context, context, context. So I'm going to talk to you about some context. I will get to the passage eventually, I promise. First of all, let's talk about Samaritans. Samaritans from the northern tribes, when the people of Israel, in the mythology of Israel, when the people of Israel entered the land, 10 tribes were in the north and 2 were in the south. They were all under David. Saul, David and Solomon had the lot. Solomon's sons couldn't hold it together. So Solomon's son Rehoboam became king of the south. There was a meeting at Shechem of all the tribes to decide whether the north would also go with Rehoboam. And they wouldn't do it because he was a tyrant oppressor. They would not join with him. So Jeroboam, his brother, took on the north. Rehoboam therefore excluded the northern tribes from access to Jerusalem, the sacred site of their religion. And Jeroboam was preparing an army to go and reclaim that right, and an unnamed prophet said, no, there should not be war between brothers. And they didn't fight. They remained as two kingdoms. So Jeroboam then set up sacred sites in the north for his people. And the sacred sites of the north reflected the common practice of the time of having multiple gods, of which Yahweh was the greatest, but others were in parallel. Now we know from our scriptures that that was a tradition that was frowned upon immensely, and the tradition of our scriptures talks about that as the reason that the people were taken from the land, that Yahweh, the one God, was angry at the people for holding other gods and destroyed the kingdoms, sent the south into exile in Babylon and destroyed the north completely by the Assyrians. Both the north and the south observed multiple gods in this period, and both of them in the narrative were supposedly punished for that. But our scriptures are the scriptures of the south, trying to find an explanation for why they got sent to Babylon and back. And the notion that there was only one God was really developed very strongly in Babylon. Prior to that, the theology was that Yahweh was the best God. Yahweh was our God. We absolutely must serve Yahweh. But the others existed. And somewhere in Babylon, there was this moment or period in which they suddenly went, you know what? Actually, the others don't exist. There aren't any others but ours. This is the only one. Which transforms then both how the way the oral traditions are then written up into our scriptures and what becomes the southern culture, what becomes Judaism. The Samaritans held to the text as far as the Pentateuch, the first 5 books, which ends with the death of Moses. So all of the stories of the common ancestors they've got, but once it gets into the kings and the prophets, they didn't consider that sacred. The prophets regarded the Samaritans as adulterous because they had taken in with other gods. Hence, the stereotype of the sexually immoral Samaritan is not just about individuals, it's about the whole nation. The Assyrian Empire destroyed the north. They exiled the people. They brought in people from other countries, and they brought in foreign gods, and it was all mingled. Somehow Galilee, which was also in the north, was later brought back into legitimate Judaism, but Samaria never was. So much so that rabbinic teaching said that Samaritan women were unclean from birth. They were menstruants from the cradle. Anything they touched became an unclean object that could make a Jew ritually unclean. So Jews didn't go through Samaria because it would make them unclean. So this text at the start says Jesus went through Samaria because he had to. Geographically, he didn't really have to. There was a much more travelled route that was slightly longer to go around it. So somehow, theologically, he had to. Jacob's well is not just any old drinking hole. It's one of the sacred sites of the Samaritan people. It's very close to Shechem, the seat of the meeting when the tribes broke, and also an ongoing seat of Samaritan worship, the place of their sacred site. They're not just meeting at any old well. But the well is important because the well, the image of meeting at a well is a really significant image in the five books that both the Jews and the Samaritans held. Both Moses and Isaac and Jacob all travelled to foreign lands and at a well met a foreign woman who they then married. So the go to foreign well and meet a bride motif is very strong. And this is Jacob's well, who is one of those three. And just in case you don't have those stories on your mind when you're reading John, chapter 3 of John brings it up, because chapter 3 has John the Baptist talking about Jesus as the bridegroom, talking about John the Baptist saying, I'm the groomsman and I am celebrating because the groom is here. I'm part of his celebration, his wedding. Immediately after that, Jesus goes to the well. Now, I think the early readers would have the man goes to foreign well and meets bride in their mind at that point. And I think that's how we're expected to be reading this passage. Again, if you're only listening to small bits, this is a key, I think. Think about this story in the framing of Old Testament stories of finding a bride. And the other piece of context I want to tell you is about water. Water is used in Hebrew scriptures and in that culture as sexual innuendo, particularly for female sexuality. So the dialogue between Jesus and the woman has all these other overtones. In Proverbs, young women, unmarried women are talked about as locked fountains. Young men are told, drink only from your own well. This image of, it's very clearly part of the culture. So, with that culture, let's have a look. With that piece of context, let's have a look at the passage. Jesus has, in chapter 2, turned the tables over in the temples and made lots of enemies. And now he's getting a larger following than John the Baptist, so the temple authorities are getting worried. So he heads for home in Galilee, deliberately going the way of the enemy people. Alone at a sacred Samaritan site, he starts a conversation with a Samaritan, and it's laden with innuendo and double or triple meanings. So at face value, it's about water. He's humanly very tired and thirsty, and he comes for a drink. But it's also flirtatious banter between both. They're both giving as good as they get. You know, get me a drink of water. Oh, are you greater than Jacob, who gave us this well? If you knew who was asking, you'd ask, I'd give you water. We don't have tone in the printed record. Now, if you're coming to this story with the find a foreign bride at a well in your mind, you might hear those conversations about water in a slightly different way. And the question about asking to go and see her husband is not out of the blue anymore. It follows. But there's also a third layer going on. Both water and sex are tangible, earthly things used to allude to greater things, and that Jesus brings this new life, more fulfilling than either. And the husband conversation draws that layer, which has been running, up to the surface. At the start, they've said, she has said to him, he says, can I have a drink? Give me a drink of water. And she says, you're a Jew. You wouldn't want to share a drink of water with me, because he would become ritually unclean. It's not said, but he's implied. And then when he gets to bring your husband, I think he's saying it again. He's saying, you're a Samaritan and I'm a Jew. You wouldn't actually want to drink water with me. Go and find your husband. That's where you actually belong. So the unlikeliness, the unlikelihood of a Jew and a Samaritan engaging in either drinking water or having sex together is raised into this story. And then the story progresses both at the level of the individual woman with her story of multiple marriages, but she also becomes more strongly a symbol for Samaria, the nation with many gods. Some people believe that there were five gods. There's a passage from Kings where the Assyrians brought in five nations with their gods. The maths doesn't quite add up because two of those nations had two gods each, so there's seven gods. But the idea of five coming in. So this, when she says you've had five husbands, it's quite possibly alluding to this sense of Samaria having engaged with, been embedded with, in both the literal and the figurative meaning of that, embedded with many gods. And John, as a gospel, is really complex. John works in layers, John sort of, and spirals. So you get a piece like this, and another bit, and another bit. And you'll get a thread if you go this way, that word connects with that word, connects with that word, connects with that word. One of the commentators said, the whole of John is in the prologue, the first 15, 20 verses, and after that it's just explaining it. And there is some truth in that. The imagery, the words, everything starts and then unfolds in pieces and layers. Everything has about four layers of meaning in John. There is no straight up telling you anything. And John is very interested in symbol. He's not interested in stereotype, but he's interested in symbol. What's the difference? A symbol is a material thing that tells of a greater reality. A stereotype is an ephemeral thing that imposes its reality onto the real. They are both ways of using ideas with things, but it depends which way you're drawing. Rather than a submissive woman waiting to be a bride, waiting to serve the groom, which is what the historic narratives, the framing of Zipporah, I should name the women, Zipporah and Rebecca and Rachel, who are the brides found at the wells, all of them say, oh yes, I'll give you a drink of water, oh yes, I'll marry you. Well, Jesus doesn't encounter a woman like that. He encounters a theologian who is ready to stand up for her people. And she asks the most important religious question of her people. If I'm right about the betrothal imagery framing this, the conversation could be seen as the negotiation towards a marriage settlement. Not between Jesus and the woman, but between Yahweh and the Samaritans. Jesus has asked about her husband, and she accepts that Samaria has not been in a long-term committed relationship with any god. There have been attempts. The sticking point about one god or many gods is raised again. And then the difficulties are expressed in these arguments about which places are sacred. Did this bit of dialogue get into the puppet play? I'm not sure if it did. About Jerusalem. She asks, she says, I see you're a prophet. So our people say the place to worship is here on Mount Gerizim, and you say you must worship at Jerusalem. Who's right, essentially? Which is the key issue of where shall we worship? And he says, you Samaritans worship what you do not know, but we worship what we do know. And still salvation is coming from the Jews. Now you could read this as saying Jews are right and Samaritans are wrong. But I think you can also read it as, I can see that the Samaritans have a heart desiring truth and seeking God. You worship, but what you do not know. They do not have the story to make sense of that. Because they finished what they accept as sacred with the story of Moses, they've missed all the ongoing clues. It's possible that the oppressive attitude of their Jewish cousins in the South has locked them out of being able to access those ongoing clues. Because so much of the scriptures of the Jews were developed in Babylon, and their real exploration of what it meant to be people of Yahweh comes out of that exile experience, but it's constructed in ways that are offensive to Samaritans. So something of the way it's been put together locks the Samaritans out of the ongoing story of the revelation of what's coming. When he says salvation comes from the Jews, he probably is saying, I am salvation and I'm Jewish. Not Jewishness will save you. So what's all this about worship in spirit and truth? I feel like I need to just nod at Peter at that point because it's his favourite verse. I would say it's probably not about inner reflection and personal devotion, because none of the rest of the passage is about individual attitude. So it would be weird for just this phrase to mean that. When I talked about John having many layers, he uses language in a coded, symbolic kind of way. And spirit and truth are both words that are part of his code language, his symbolic language for God. Which, if you then couple them up with the rest of the verse, which he says, this is what the Father wants, spirit and truth, you get the Trinity! You get the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, the truth is Jesus, the Father. Bang! Three! So this is actually a trump card passage for people explaining Trinitarian dogma, doctrine. That's a slip. I'm not going to talk about the Trinity because, as you can see, it's not something I sit easily with. I think John is saying that worship or religious understanding is no longer going to be about your tradition and my tradition, your sacred place and my sacred place, but about the presence of the living God. The mountains, which have been barriers between us, are going to be removed from the equation, and this living water is going to bubble up wherever it pleases. The Samaritan woman Samaritan religion is like the literal water. It needs to keep coming back to the well. It needs to keep drawing again and again. And Jesus is saying this true relationship is like a living thing where you do not need to keep coming back and coming back. It is a fulfilling thing. Jesus is the new temple in our midst. The new burning bush, someone said to me, where the place where God is now present. Both the Jews and the Samaritans expected a Messiah, but the Samaritans expected a Messiah in the Moses tradition, and the Jews expected a Messiah in the David tradition. So the Jews were expecting a Messiah in the political kingly tradition, whereas the Samaritans were expecting a Messiah who was a teaching Messiah. So when Jesus accepts, when she says, I know the Messiah is coming, and he says, I am he accepts, it seems, the Samaritan idea of being a teaching Messiah. When the Jews later on say, are you the Messiah? He's very evasive. He's not so prepared to have the political kingly Messiah label put on him. And he uses words that could be translated as Yahweh. I heard the Messiah is coming, and it could easily be translated as Yahweh, I am, is the one speaking to you. It's usually translated as, I am he, meaning I am the Messiah of who you speak. But the same words could go both ways. The disciples return and they see Jesus with a stereotype. This emphasises the symbolic layers, and it says, don't notice it and don't pay attention to the stereotype. What is Jesus seeing, not what are the disciples suspecting? Who is she in this story, not is who is she in my bigoted view of the world? So the woman goes back to her village. In the bride at the well stories, part of the framing is that the woman races back to her people to tell who she's met, and here she does exactly that. And she uses the phrasing that's reminiscent of the messianic expectations of the Samaritans. He told me everything I ever did. If you're expecting a Messiah who will explain everything, is she talking about the fact that he knew her sexual history or that he understood the Samaritan people? Then there's a dialogue with the disciples, which is quite strange, about food and doing the will of God, the harvest, reaping and sowing. I'm not going to concentrate on this because there's so much in there, but I think overall it's saying things are coming together that have been scattered. They have been germinating in the earth of both the Jewish and the Samaritan history. And you disciples are here at the point of the harvest. You are eating the food rather than labouring for it. And the feast that you are participating in is to do the will of God. Jesus says, I have food, my food is to do the will of God, and you are part of this harvest. It's more life-giving than bread, which echoes the themes of it's more life. The water I give is a different sort of water. That theme of bread, John will pick up again. He'll bring the layer again and talk about it in detail a few chapters on, about Jesus being the bread. And the Samaritans, it seems, accept the invitation to a marriage. They are not subsumed into the Jewish story, but they see Jesus as the saviour of the world, something beyond the narrow Jewish visions which the Samaritans had problems with, but also something woven through the Jewish story and emerging out of it. I'm nearly at the end, so if you're only listening to bits, rejoin us for the end. I think it's saying something greater than your religious traditions is coming and has come. Something that will be your food and your drink, something that energises your days, the living God. And this applies to us across centuries. I think this is where we re-enter the story as with our issues and our concerns, with what we bring today. We're not Jews or Samaritans. But we are still sought out by this living God, the saviour of the world. It's a very big, it's the cosmos, far beyond first century Palestine. Who is this living God? This passage over and over, I think, shows God as bounteous, sustaining people beyond the precarious material reality of living beside a well, beside a harvest field that could get flattened. Living God who is water beyond water, an eternal spring welling up. Who is satisfaction beyond sex, the joy of this restored relationship. Jesus the bridegroom, restoring covenant to all humans as beloved. This living God is bread beyond bread. The food is to do the will of God. What energizes us is God's purpose, not material necessities. So a more than material reality is revealed through these material realities, the essence of symbol, more than material revealed through a story in material language. And yes, this is a God revealed in the person and practice of Jesus who does reach across boundaries, who does walk into the ghetto and make it home, who does see individuals rather than categories, and who draws us with him into this same wide-armed attitude to all people. I'm happy to take questions. Oh, the hands go up. Goodness, John.
Samaritans were the people they didn't take. They weren't taken to Babylon. And in Babylon, the captives learned a lot of things.
Yeah.
So when they came back, they regarded the people who hadn't gone to Babylon as being very ignorant and looked down on them. But the people who didn't go were the Samaritans.
Not quite. There is a story about the elites of the south were exiled to Babylon and left the peasants behind. And then in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, when the people of Babylon are allowed to come back, there's conflict with the people who've left behind. But that's the remnant southern peasants. But the northern tribes, the Assyrians decimate before the Babylonian. So the Assyrian takes out the northern ten. And it's the northern part that becomes Samaria and is where the Samaritans develop. And they're partly people who are left behind, and they're partly people who have come from other places. The Assyrian policy was to take people from a place they'd captured and plant them in another place they'd captured to break up social bonds and to break up that connection. So the Samaritan people are a mestizo, a Creole people of the north, married together with lots of different tribes, including some who would have been remnant northern Israelites, but certainly not the majority. They saw themselves as legitimate descendants of Abraham, but the south did not. And I haven't been able to find if it was only the elites removed in the north, because that would make an interesting story of the Jews in the south not liking the peasant cousins in the north, but I couldn't find anything to say that was what happened.
Not a question, Claire, but a comment. When you first started talking, I envisaged that a modern equivalent of Jesus talking to a Samaritan woman would be a Jew going to the West Bank and talking to a Palestinian. The Palestinians occupy the same sort of land. They see themselves as descendants of Abraham, but the Jews see them as heretics because they're mainly Muslims. And then as you were talking near the end, it struck me that the Palestinians are mainly Muslims, but there's a lot of Christian Palestinians there who are effectively have inherited the teachings of Jesus. And I find it quite awesome that in the midst of all that turmoil and conflict, there are little pockets of Christian Palestinians who today effectively are fulfilling that interaction that happened at the well.
Mm. Mm. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, Claire. I was interested in your early comment about John, the author, as being almost anti-patriarchal in his depiction of women, and that some also see him possibly as almost anti-racist as well, in that sense that this story particularly is held up. Can you sort of, are there any other examples of John sort of being like this in the rest of the books? And is there any sort of explanation about why, in terms of who John is?
Yeah. Have you got another half hour? I'll do it. I'll give you the quickest version I can. Several of John's named women characters almost always are characters with enough in them that you could say are challenging stereotypes. Mary and Martha, who are heading a household. Mary Magdalene, who somehow is able to be the first witness to the resurrection. Some commentators think that arises out of a community that had women leadership, and that these stories come out of John being familiar with female spirituality and women in leadership. Others suggest that the author of John is trying not to establish another hierarchy, and so by having the strong characters be women, there's a sense of, well, we know that would never happen, so no one's going to accidentally turn that into a hierarchy, so that's safe. We can allow those characters to hold the lead because it doesn't actually create a new hierarchy. I think it's more likely that there were women in his community with some leadership. There's a lot of argument about who John was writing to, but he was probably writing to a community that had arisen out of Judaism and saw themselves as continuing the Jewish tradition, but had been cast out of the synagogues, had been told, you are not Jews, you cannot come, which has parallels here. But probably not that far, probably still Palestinian or not that far from, possibly in Syria or in the north, so possibly still in that area. But it's not clear. They really don't know who John was or who he was writing to.
Just following up on that comment, the significance of John's attention to women in the gospel narrative, it comes through in some of the sermons of John Chrysostom, who homes in on this quite a lot, and also the number of women who are recognised in the letters of Paul. And John Chrysostom liked to draw his attention's audience to this, and particularly when you get to the crucifixion scenes and the women who are there at the foot of the cross while the men hold back. And his comment is, who were the real men that day? And that's one of his popular phrases. So you can see that it's not just a nice extra to have. This is very important. Gospel message to be reinforced, to break down those stereotypes and those social habits, as it were. I actually had another question. You said about where the Samaritans only recognised the first five books of the Pentateuch, because that was the common, the thing which they were in agreement with the Judeans, but that there was a lot more development that happened in exile about the idea of a one God over all the world. But those five books, they begin with a story of a universal creator creating the world out of nothing. So it's not just the mightiest of all the gods, it is the story begins with the one, the singular God. And so that, when did that story get into those books, and how did they get into the hands of the Samaritans who have been holding on to this prior to the exiles returning? It's just the sequence of it.
The tradition is certainly held and passed on, and the Pentateuch certainly holds the idea of Yahweh as the greatest God, that because we're used to expecting that to mean Yahweh is the only God, that's what we tend to hear. There are certainly, the creation story is one in particular that reads very strongly as that God was there and God created. And I don't know the detailed history of how that comes out, but certainly a lot of the oral traditions were pulled together in exile in a way that was structured, particularly as the emergence of the importance of the priesthood and the importance of that intermediary Jerusalem temple role, or how that worked in exile and how that worked when you came back. And that's strongly an editing flavour. Old Testament scholars look at the Pentateuch and they talk about four different sources, of which only one is really strongly that, but it's the strong one that edits it, that holds it together. Yeah. And it's clearly already there in the Davidic period, because that temple period is there, but they had the time in Babylon to sit down and think about it and pull it together in a different way.
Oh, I'll have the last question then. Maybe a little elephant in the room, that's the narrator. 90 years after the events, often recording stories where he wasn't present, which then means that he's second hand, probably third hand. So everything you're saying about symbolism takes on a much greater role, because he's got a pretty big hand in the composition of what goes in that book.
He's not telling a history. He's creating a religious document for the purpose of getting people to follow Jesus. And he's using historical accounts to weave into that, but he's not telling a history. Who told this story that it's on the record? Did the Samaritan woman tell it? Is this a Samaritan woman's story that it's in our scripture at all? Is that where we've got it from? Or did Jesus sit down and tell his disciples this happened? Or did it not happen, but someone thought it should have, and so write it because it epitomised the way he was in general, and they needed to make it into one piece to tell it as a story. The disciples don't come out in John very glowing at any point. Yeah. You can't have the last word, Paul. It's...
That's okay, I don't have it at home either.
With what you've said so far, is there any suggestion that the Book of John actually was written by a group of women?
Who I've put not the name read of anyone John who's prepared to go separate. That far.
Okay.
Like a lot of stories, this reminds me of a situation where you've got a bunch of people sitting down with a pile of old photos, trying to put them together and interpret the story that the photos tell, and they've really only got little snippets and they're trying to put it together.
Mm. Nobody else. We've got a wedding to go to.
We do. Yeah. Thank you.